You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 11 September. We've got U.S. August inflation due at 2:30 our time, expected 2.6%. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Jimmy Muyaha, as AngloGold Ashanti buys an Egyptian gold mine using mostly equity. Jackie Van Niekerk from Attack results, the dividend up nicely. The waterfall at Mall of Africa doing incredibly well. Renee Swanepoel from Morningstar South Africa, data that shows that chasing returns actually leads to lower returns. This show is brought to you by StanLib. Visit StanLib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Anglo American commences the Anglo Platinum demerger, announces accelerated book build amongst institutional investors to start the process of offloading its 78% stake. Business Day, factory output bounces back in July. Economic activity in manufacturing sector increased, starting the third quarter on a positive note. Morning markets, US was green, NASDAQ up 0.9%, S&P up 0.5%. The East is red, Sydney down 0.4%, Tokyo off 0.8%, Hong Kong down 1.5%, and Tencent down 0.5%. Commodities mostly green, gold 2,548, Brent is red at 69.61, platinum 947, palladium 972, the Rand is 1792, Bitcoin 56,700, and top 40 opening call, red open, 340 points or almost 0.5% lower.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Turning now with Jimmy Muyaha. Jimmy, appreciate the time. The AngloGold Ashanti, they're buying that Egyptian mine, Sukara, $2.5 billion valuation. All in sustained costs, a little under $1,200 an ounce. That's not bad. Should add almost 500,000 ounces to production. All in all, I mean, it looks like a good deal. I got perhaps two concerns. One is, I mean, is this kind of top of cycle? You should be buying at bottom of cycle. And using equity, they make the point that it maintains their strong balance sheet, but equity rather than cash. I mean, the new shareholders are going to get what? Some 16%. Your take on the deal?
Yeah, morning, Simon. I think with M&A deals, especially at this time, they kind of go one of two ways, right? They either really are a no-brainer or they do leave questions. And I kind of share the concerns that you have around this particular deal. I mean, if we look back to the Northern Implats bid for RBF a while ago, that was a similar thing. At the top of the platinum cycle, post that, the platinum price has come down quite a bit. This increases AngloGold's concentration in the gold space. It still doesn't make them one of the biggest gold producers, but to have a balance sheet or to have assets of around $12 billion when the likes of Barrick Gold and that are north of $20 billion is something they've been working towards to say they want to try and narrow that gap from their perspective. But in terms of the deal itself, I mean, the balance sheet is strong enough to not have to do the equity portion of that. And that raises the question as to what does that mean for the equity or the AngloGold share price afterwards. I mean, yesterday we saw off the back of this announcement, the share price was down almost 10%. It did recover throughout the day, obviously, as the market digested the data and digested the deal. But one has to wonder, does this now... is the concentration in the gold space warranted at the current gold price? Gold prices have never been this high in the history of gold prices. And so how much higher are they really going to go? Yes, you do get the benefit from bringing in those all-in sustained costs down because your all-in sustained costs as a group might be higher at the moment. And so you can reduce that as well. But when the cycle does turn, and it will turn, what is the bottom of your gold price looking like? Is it still going to be above $2,000? Is it going to come below that? And are you still going to be making money for the 500,000 ounces that you're going to, or 450,000 ounces that you are now going to add with this new acquisition? Is that increase in production warranted compared to what you're doing to the equity of the business?
And I take a point at all of that. And what also strikes me, and more broadly, we just don't see greenfield projects anymore. That just seems to, I mean, I was reading a report that greenfield projects take on average 13 years from discovery to final production. And the mining companies are just, it's easier to buy somebody.
Absolutely. This is not the first time you and I have spoken about this as well. Especially for the miners at this point, it is much easier to say there's a good operating asset. Let's add that asset to our portfolio. You look at the likes of Harmony that have gone into Canada as well in a similar kind of deal, 1.2 billion rand acquisition or billion dollar acquisition on their part. It's definitely easier, especially for the larger miners. You look at BHP that wanted to come out and buy the Anglo Group in South Africa. There is always a conversation around we could go start something from the ground up and completely start something new, but the capital deployment that goes into that, the infrastructure deployment and the initial setup cost for something like that doesn't make sense for mining companies, especially well-established mining companies at this point that are able to leverage off of their balance sheets and say, look, we're just going to add to the portfolio, strengthen the balance sheet, strengthen the income, increase overall profitability within the cycle and consolidate our space. And unlike other sectors, mining companies typically have a lot lower in terms of takeover requirements and resistance in terms of controlling markets and that sort of thing. So they're able to go into other geographies, other regions where they understand what they're mining, they understand the product and just say, we're just going to buy this asset. It's a really good asset.
Yeah, and as you say that, we never have competition commission issues with miners. It's just like an absolute carte blanche. Help yourself. We'll leave it there, Jimmy. We are independent analyst, and our poll today on LinkedIn and Twitter, is this a good-looking deal? I'm an AngloGold Ashanti shareholder. I don't mind the deal so much. I wish they were doing cash rather than equity. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter.
MoneyWeb now. On the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Jackie Van Niekerk, CEO at Attack. Results for year end June, dividend up 19%, gearing down at 25.4%, occupancy across the group at 92.8%. Jackie, appreciate the early morning time. Occupancy at Mall of Africa below 1%. This really is a premium asset in the space, and I imagine that must give you that low level of occupancy, must give you a level of pricing power with existing and perhaps new tenants coming through.
Yeah, good morning and thanks for having me. Definitely so. You know, we come back 3 years ago with the days of COVID. We had a big final renewal cycle in Mall of Africa. You know, we had to, you know, we were price takers. And I think it shifted to where we're more the price makers. You know, if you don't have space, pricing tension becomes a great conversation. So we are very blessed and fortunate to have the high occupancy in Mall of Africa. Our tenants trading incredibly well. And that fortunate gives us a positive reversion in our rentals, which ultimately that's what we want to see as landlords.
100%. And I imagine that part of this, I mean, the foot traffic must be really strong. I mean, if tenants are doing well, that's because people are visiting and enjoying the overall experience.
Yeah, it's always hard work. You know, trends and retail shifts dramatically. And again, post-COVID, the online trend has definitely shifted. And we had to find our space. You know, where is a mall going to play? You know, if people can buy their dog food online. And, you know, and we, you know, we feel that a mall is a place where people can come together, community, activity, and bring that relevant trends and product to the market that they can't, you know, buy online. So it's constant work of how to keep our relevance and keep our shoppers and the footfall high.
It's that trend. And if I go back and if I look back a long time, yeah, I don't know, maybe 2 decades ago. So a mall was somewhere where I went and did shopping, bought my dog food, maybe saw a movie, maybe had a meal. It's become much more of an experience these days. And that's been a strategic process from the management companies across the sector.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's an experience. You know, again, what we've learned coming out of the last few years is people like people and we want to be around the energy of people. So we really designed a mall where you can buy great product. You can go into Checkers. And I mean, they've just been phenomenal, the retailer as Checkers. It's still an experience going into a hyper store and buying your product. But it's a place for people to come together. But you can also going to just everything coexist and work together. And then also I think Checkers 6060 and Dash fulfilling from our shopping centres.
Yeah.
It's a different dynamic that is also adding to shopping centres.
100%. You did the deal, it was almost a year ago, but obviously in these numbers, there were two parts. One was the Government Employees Pension Fund, and then you buying the remaining stake in Mall in Africa. You also exited your position in Mass PLC. That's really strengthened the balance sheet. I mentioned gearing 25.4%, a very strong balance sheet that you're sitting on, but a lot more development in the broader waterfall city as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we sit with an exposure of just over 1 million square meters of development bulk. A large component is attributable to logistics. Mm-hmm. And we're really excited about the inquiries. And we hope to see, you know, converting those inquiries into transactions and then developments in the near coming months. And we've got the firepower and the balance sheet now to, you know, to execute on more transactions than in the past. So I think the transactions, you know, all came together all in 1 year, kept our finance team very busy, but we're really proud of the transaction and it all coming together.
And a lot of that development you mentioned there is logistics. I mean, of course, we talk more of Africa. Attack is perhaps best known for the shopping centre, to use an old phrase. But logistics is an important part, and perhaps more important going forward, as a lot more development happens in that space.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're currently busy and we've concluded phase one of a data center as well. You know, mm-hmm. we never talk about it. It's one of the biggest and first hyperscale facilities in South Africa with the co-owner Vantage. We're busy building phase two. We've got three more phases to construct on the data center side. And then logistics. Again, I call it waterfall being the center of gravity in Gauteng, great road infrastructure. So all roads lead to waterfall. But again, coming back to logistics, it's a incredible road infrastructure. So again, setting off your product is a great center point for the logistics guys.
Last question, office. You don't have a lot of office. Your focus is retail. Your focus is logistics. But office broadly in your space and broadly across the sector, it's still tough out there.
Yeah, it's tough. But we are seeing people coming back to the office. You know, again, trends have shifted so quick and dramatically. So the hybrid office work is here to stay. But I think what corporates are realizing is we need the office space as well, where people can come together, the water cooler talk, the innovation, the ideation. How does it always happen on Teams? again, it's human nature to come together. So corporates are taking up space. It's smaller space. They're actually also spending quite a bit in their fit out, really to entice employees to come back to the office, and also, you know, that whole experience of being at the office. So I think the jury's still out, and we're starting to see a nice shift back where people are back in the office, and it encourages us because we still like building, and you know, and we own quite a bit of offices, so we're very encouraged with the trend shifting back towards the office.
And I like your point. I don't think innovation happens on Teams. I think you're 100% right. Jackie van Niekerk, CEO of Attack, appreciate the early morning time.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Renee Swanepoel. She's head of sales at Morningstar South Africa. Renee, great to have you on the show again. Perils of performance chasing. I mean, one of the perhaps most telling parts is that every investment product has a disclaimer around past performance, not an indication of future returns. But my sense is a lot of us kind of look past that and kind of think that we can chase performance and that it can work in our favor.
Absolutely, Simon. It's something we all do. If I think about investing, there's this thing we call behavioral biases, and that really guides the way we actually, what we do with our investments. And performance chasing is one of the main ones when we think about behavioral biases, that fear of missing out.
Yeah, and that belief. And it, you know, I remember my early days in sort of finding my way through the markets. This is easy. You buy low, you sell high, and you get rich. Of course, we never know what's low, we never know what's high, and we never get rich either.
Absolutely. It's everyone loves a winner. You want to own everything that's winning. It's just the nature of how we are. But it is. It seems like such an easy thing to do. Buy low, sell high. That's the golden rule to investing, but it's actually very difficult to do in practice because that behavioral biases kick in.
Yeah, and hard for individuals like myself and many of the listeners, but also for fund managers. You did some data crunching. The S&P Dow Jones does a persistence scorecard. And what you did was you got the CISA SA General Equity Funds, looked at returns over a 10-year period up to end of June, and then compared how they'd done over the period. And what stood out starkly was that, yep, those that had had a great 10 years, it had been a cumulative over the period. It wasn't every single year was an out-and-out winner.
Yeah. If you look at the returns of those best-performing equity funds over the last 10 years, and you just look at their returns every single year, over that 10 years, yes, top-performing. But if you look deep into those calendar year performances, every single fund out of all of those 25 funds that were the top performers over the 10 years spent at least 1 year in the third quartile, and 20 of them spent at least 1 year in the fourth quartile. So at point, those best performing funds were all bottom quartile. So you would have had that behavioral bias of now's the time to sell them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I often say to folks that the best advice is just to kind of buy and stop looking. But you also then, you took it a step further and you created a hypothetical performance chasing fund where every year you buy the previous year's best fund, hold it for the year and then repeat again. And that also underperformed. So even just buying last year's winner didn't actually give you better return over the longer term.
Exactly. When you went to look to exactly that performance chaser portfolio, it takes an investor with R1 million. It says, I'm going to rank all of the funds from last year, from the best performing fund to the worst performing fund. I'm just going to take my full million and I'm going to invest it into last year's best performer. And you just did that every single year. And you compare that to a portfolio that you just stuck with, a good diversified portfolio, you would have ended up, that difference in end return is over R1 million over the long term, which is, it's quite a big number if you think about it, just almost closing your eyes, investing for the long term or trying to chase those winners.
And this isn't because the fund managers are bad. It's just that fund returns, well, market returns are lumpy. You might be, you know, you have a bet on something and it pays out this year, but it, you know, not next year. Or maybe, I mean, I sometimes just get lucky in the market.
Exactly. There's times when a fund performs well, there's going to be times where a fund performs badly. And what you really want to do is that diversified portfolio, different styles, different asset classes, different sectors, different geographies. And that really is going to get you to your long-term goal rather than trying to chase those winners.
And I suppose then as a solution, and I'm going to say it's simple, but maybe it's simple because we are talking about it and not practically trying to do it, is we stop chasing the returns, we buy within our risk profile, we be diverse, and then we let time do its work. And we appreciate that it's going to be a rocky road at times.
And when you're an investor, you sometimes think you invested for the long term. So if you invested for the long term and your goals are long term, it excuses you from all the short-term movements. But when you invest for the long-term, it actually means that you have more short-term movements that you have to deal with throughout your investing journey. So I think reminding yourself of that is that the long-term doesn't excuse you from the short-term market moves. It just makes it that you're going to have to deal with a lot more of them. And I think that gives you some comfort of if you can stick it through those short-term movements and you can focus on the long-term, that is, at the end of the day, the best thing you can do in your investment portfolio. And exactly like you said, diversification is almost that. We always say the free lunch is diversification.
Yeah. And it comes back to what you said at the top. You know, investing is supposedly cold, hard numbers, and the analysts are crunching the numbers and the funds are buying the best. But it's so much emotion to it. And what we've got to do is try. I was going to say manage. It's hard. Try and shut out that emotion in the short term.
Exactly. The less emotion in your investment portfolio, the better for your long-term investment returns.
Yeah. Less emotion, better returns. Easy to say, maybe harder to do. Renee Swanepoel, Head of Sales, Morningstar South Africa. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. I was chatting with Evan Walker from 361 Asset Management yesterday, talking local retailer results and updates that we have seen so far. We asked you how you felt the local retail valuations were. Almost half said a mixed bag, a third said expensive, the rest were saying it sectors offering great value. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobokle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us an awesome rating in your podcatcher of choice. We'll chat again tomorrow. The Rand, third best currency year to date.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.